Okay, welcome to another lecture for the history section of Japanese 100. Today we're going to, as always, start off with a review of the last lecture, which was about the war itself, World War II for Japan. Specifically, last time we focused on two things. Rather than focusing, I've suggested it's about the war itself, but rather than focusing on the military history of this battle and that battle, although we touched on those things, the more sort of important things to understand are how and why Japan made its decision to go to war with the US, and why that was a big mistake, and this idea of the greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. So last time, we talked about the Pacific War, which began with the assault on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, and the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, which was this idea about how to sort of unify Asia, of course, under Japan, with Japan at the top of the hierarchy as the true and natural and righteous leader of Asia, defending the region and its people against evil white Western aggression. We talked about some of the problems internally in the Japanese decision-making process and in the infighting between the army and navy, and how that sort of held back the war effort, which was probably doomed anyway, because ultimately it was, in many ways, a war about resources that Japan simply did not have and could not get through the kind of military aggression that it brought to bear in the Pacific region, and which was probably, as I've suggested, ultimately intended to be a bargaining chip rather than an actual declaration of war. So this time we are going to get along to the post-war, the process of surrender, and sort of what happens after that with the US occupation. In April 1945, a future Japanese statesman and a Tokyo University professor discussed a story of a warrior who starved himself to buy a coat of armor, only to find that he was too weak to fight in it. This was just what had happened to Japan, they agreed. Japan would probably have to give up its arms, but this could be a blessing in disguise. It would achieve more of its aims in business suits than it had in uniforms. By this point, intelligent and informed Japanese, at least outside the military, were by and large more than willing to surrender. As one American historian commented, generations of Americans have been taught that the United States reluctantly dropped atom bombs on Japan at the end of World War II to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of young men poised to die if the US invaded Japan. But the real story is more complicated and much more disturbing. Unsurprisingly, the story told in Japan is different. It's different from both the most common American version and also from the more complicated and more disturbing reality. Beginning with Hirohito's surrender speech, the awesome destructive power of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were narrated in terms of not just Japanese victimization, but also, they were sort of an opportunity for Japan to literally save civilization itself and life on the planet through surrender and rebuilding. So this was also a story about the terrifying inhumanity of the West. The emperor, whose high, tinny voice and stilted, antiquated, courtly diction had never been heard by more than a handful of Japanese, took to the airwaves on August 15th, 1945, for the first time. This was an unprecedented step, which was proposed by Hirohito himself. And it turns out that this address was completed and recorded at the last minute and in great secrecy to avoid interference by the military. And it turns out this was a wise choice, because army diehards apparently stormed the palace in an attempt to destroy the record once they learned of the planned surrender broadcast. Despite its chaotic genesis, as John Dower noted, the rescript, this imperial surrender document, the so-called jewel voice broadcast, emerged as a polished ideological gem. This was, quite literally, divine intervention. The speech, which, though its archaic language and poor sound quality, was quite difficult, that all made it quite difficult for ordinary Japanese to comprehend without summaries which followed. This speech was immediately translated and reported around the world, and it is truly a rhetorical masterpiece from start to finish. It deserves to be read all the way through, so I recommend that you do that. Still, the core and the essence of Hirohito's address is contained in a three-paragraph section. So here are the three paragraphs that I want to talk about. Two of them sort of contain this idea of sort of Japan's special mission in the world. And one of them is this just absolutely astonishing understatement about how the war was going. So first, Hirohito said, "We declared war on America and Britain out of our sincere interest, our sincere desire to ensure Japan's self-preservation and the stabilization of East Asia." He goes on to say, "Now the war has lasted nearly 4 years." And of course, here he's only talking about the war with the Western powers, the US in particular. "Despite the best that has been done by everyone, the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage, while the general trends of the world have all turned against her interest." This is this mind-boggling understatement that I mentioned before. Finally, we get back to the special mission. So here we are, sandwiching the bad news with the good news. "Moreover, the enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage is indeed incalculable, taking the toll of many innocent lives. Should we continue to fight, not only would it result in an ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation, but also it would lead to the total extinction of human civilization." So we're going to play a little bit of the audio of the speech itself. It of course goes on like this, and as I mentioned, if you're not able to follow it and understand it, you're not alone. Most of the people who listened at the time had a very hard time understanding all of the words, even if the message got across fairly quickly and fairly clearly. We should also remember that Prime Minister Konoe had warned Hirohito in February not only that defeat was inevitable and that Japan would eventually lose or be forced to surrender, but that, quote, as he put it, we must worry about a communist revolution that might accompany defeat. Actually, in a paranoid outburst that probably dulled the impact of the message, Konoe attributed Japan's entire war effort to the control faction, i.e., Tojo, etc., which he claimed had supplanted the Imperial Way faction and stymied plans for the northern advance in China because, he said, they were actually Bolsheviks who wanted to foment communist revolution and bring down the emperor and the Kokutai. By bringing Japan to the brink of destruction, the control faction, he claimed, had laid the foundations for a communist takeover. Apparently, the bad guys here had blunted the northern advance because they supported the Soviets and also Mao Zedong's communists on the continent. Japan, in other words, had been undone not by the military radicals who brought it to the brink of war with the Soviet Union, but by the calculating bureaucrats who won control of army policy after the February 1936 revolt. The entire idea that Tojo Hideki, among others, is a communist is so ludicrous it hardly bears mentioning. On the other hand, Konoe was perhaps the single most influential person in Japan because he was an actual friend to the emperor who had the kind of status where he could go and sit down and chat. He was probably the only person in Japan who could do this. And so if this level of sort of nutso conspiracy theory kind of thinking was permeating even those upper levels, it's very hard to know, what if any rational thinking was going on in the upper echelons of Japanese decision making at the time. In any case, having been forewarned of an important broadcast, many Japanese citizens and subjects in the home islands, in the colonies, and on the battlefronts were crowded around their radios awaiting a momentous announcement, though few could possibly have expected a declaration of surrender, de facto not legal, but a declaration of de surrender nonetheless. Some collapsed, some were shell-shocked, many shed tears. But they were not, as the media quickly tried to portray them, universally the tears of a people anguished by the suffering which they had caused to the emperor by losing his war. Rather, they reflected a multitude of sentiments apart from emperor-centered grief, as John Dower put it. Tears were shed in anguish, regret, bereavement, anger at having been deceived, sudden emptiness and loss of purpose, or simple joy at the unexpected surcease of misery and death. And while neither the precise meaning or implications of this earth-shattering speech, the Jewel Voice broadcast, were immediately clear to everyone, while reactions also varied from sorrow to anger to emptiness to joy, at the official level, the most notable immediate response to the momentous broadcast of August 15th was pragmatic and self-serving. Military officers and civilian bureaucrats throughout the country threw themselves frenetically into the tasks of destroying their files and disbursing vast hoards of military supplies in illicit ways. Although the emperor's broadcast put an end to the American air raids, it was said, with a fine touch of hyperbole, that the skies over Tokyo remained black with smoke for days to come. Bonfires of documents replaced napalm's hellfires as the wartime elites followed the lead of their sovereign and devoted themselves to obscuring their wartime deeds. With similar cynical alacrity and practicality, the government began recruiting women to work as prostitutes for the coming army of occupation. On August 18th, and remember the speech was August 15th, planning officially began for a system of domestic recreation and amusement centers to mirror the so-called comfort stations, where a number of mostly enslaved and indentured women, the so-called comfort women, had served Japanese soldiers on the various battlefronts. Very soon, thousands of women had been made into a bastion, protecting the purity and chastity of the majority of Japanese women against what was evidently assumed to be an impending tidal wave of American raping and pillaging. Given the conduct of Japan's soldiers during the war, this was not a particularly surprising assumption. But the whole enterprise was shut down by the US occupation in January 1946, And the reason for this was that it both A, offended General Douglas MacArthur's Christian sensibilities, and he was in charge, and it was also the source of an epidemic of gonorrhea and other STDs in the Allied troops, who were happily taking advantage of all the prostitution. The stories that we can learn from the history both of the so-called comfort women, this system of military sex slavery, in most considered opinions, and at least of military brothels with forced labor, in the sort of mildest way you could factually put it, as well as the post-war sexual history of the occupation and Japan is quite complicated. There are lots of good works on this, and if you are interested in learning more about it, there is definitely a lot of reading out there that can be done. Another very pragmatic thing that began to happen immediately after the war was black markets, which began appearing around Japan. They were, of course, referred to as blue sky markets, and they were, in fact, just making more visible and giving a sort of more permanent sight to phenomena that were already a fact of life by the end of the war. In other words, that black markets had existed, but the very tough military police sort of crackdowns on them during the war had made them essentially impossible to set up in a kind of semi-permanent way. It's estimated that about 17,000 black markets were operating around Japan by October of 1945, and they sold both American and Japanese military supplies, loot from the dead, and whatever else could be scrounged up. As the Japanese historian Oguma Eiji has pointed out, as it had been in wartime, though scarcity was a national crisis, it was most acute in the cities. This led to scenes of thousands of city dwellers boarding trains to the countryside, attempting to barter anything and everything that they owned for food. The spectacle of urbanites trading kimonos for cabbage was referred to as onion peeling, because the bourgeois shed tears along with their layers of clothing. Those who could trade kimonos were lucky, though. After all, you can't eat a kimono, which meant that many farmers had very little motivation to barter away their precious food for such useless commodities. Rural Japan had suffered the slings and arrows of the interwar years, but had been the subject of wartime adulation by the government, which, as we've talked about, saw the villages as the epitome and treasure trove of unwesternized, authentic, collectivist, anti-modern Japanese culture. On the other hand, the cities had prospered in the 20s, but during the period of war and recovery, the urban middle class suffered the combined impact of bombings, food shortages, and inflation, while the position of villagers who grew their own food and whose homes were not destroyed by bombing was relatively improved. Needless to say, this urban-rural disparity was the source of great animosity and anger, as it had been before, just more or less in reverse. For some farmers, at least, this new era must have been a time of gloating about comeuppances. Let's return, though, to August 1945 and the date of the Emperor's radio debut, August 15th. In Japan, this is remembered as the date of the end of the war. There's even a national holiday, Shusen Kinenbi, the date to commemorate the end of the war. It wasn't, though, and the assertion that this broadcast somehow ended the war is a bizarre vestige of the emperor-centered worldview that dominated the years of Japan's empire and its wars in the 20th century. Parenthetically, it is an actual holiday in South Korea and China, the day the light returned in Korea and VJ Day in China, in other words, Victory Against Japan Day. In any case, August 15th, 1945 was both too early and too late to celebrate the end of the war. Japan's surrender didn't come officially, legally, until September 22nd, excuse me, 2nd, in an elaborate and intentionally humiliating surrender ceremony on the deck of the American battleship Missouri, which a portion of which is pictured here. And the war had really been over in all but name for months, with the cities of Japan destroyed, its armies decimated, supplies of essential materials for both military and civilian use either dried up or dwindling with frightening rapidity, and 3 million Japanese soldiers and civilians dead, and probably about three times that many homeless. Most recently, Japan, as it would remind the world with gusto in the coming decades, had become the first victim of atomic bombings in August, with two major cities not just obliterated in a literal flash, but made into laboratories for the effects of radiation on the human body. Questions about the American decision to use the bomb have been asked often and have provoked contentious, angry debate. There's a whole cottage industry examining this fateful choice, and it's quite fiery, with partisans squaring off for decades, repeating the same arguments about the military priority of saving lives, mostly American, of course. On the other hand, President Truman's desire to give the U.S. the upper hand in the post-war order by intimidating Stalin. The need to justify the $2 billion invested in the Manhattan Project to develop the bomb to begin with. And a toxic mix of Japanese propaganda, American racism and Orientalism, which made the Japanese appear to be this sort of hive-minded no-surrender vermin, etc., etc. Now here, rather than engaging in this debate, as I've said, it's gone on since 1945, so we're really not going to solve anything here, I think it would be more fruitful to explore the reasons why Japan didn't surrender until after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As I said in the last lecture, the Battle of Midway was really the fatal for Japan's Navy, and that came already in the summer of 1942. Fatal for the Japanese Navy is synonymous for fatal for the Japanese Empire, because it was fundamentally a maritime or naval empire. It's worth pointing out that while Yamamoto Isoroku's audacious attack on Pearl Harbor had been the first to make really effective large-scale use of carrier-based assault groups and the deadly torpedo bombs developed specially for this task, these same strategies of carrier-based naval warfare and air superiority were quickly turned on Japan, with far more devastating effect, by the United States. In other words, the Japanese invented the strategy that brought them down. As Jansen wrote, the Doolittle raid of April 1942, in which bombers took off from an American carrier just 600 miles from Japan, did slight material damage, but had important psychological consequences. Yamamoto decided it would be necessary to add Midway Atoll to the defense perimeter and marshaled all his strength for a gigantic contest that took place in early June of 1942. Japan lost, and this was the beginning of the end. Even if this was not obvious at the time, at the very latest, when Saipan fell in 1944, in the summer of 1944, and American B-29s started to annihilate Japan's major cities one by one, the situation was obviously irrefutably hopeless. Some in officialdom in Japan had begun to contemplate the possibility of a road to peace through a negotiated surrender. However, for the ruling clique of army men, although victory was out of the question, the alternative was not acceptable. Even when the capital, Tokyo, was subjected to the unprecedented firebombing of March 1945, the courage for a swift, unconditional surrender was nowhere to be found. Even when almost 10 million Japanese abandoned the cities to seek shelter in the countryside, the courage for a swift and unconditional surrender was nowhere to be found. Even when rations of meat, fish, and fresh milk had all but ceased, growing malnutrition led to a rise in the incidence of tuberculosis, rickets, and adolescent eye diseases, taxes soared, prices increased, and black markets flourished, and even university students, the promise of the future once exempted from military conscription, were recruited for service at the front, the courage for a swift and unconditional surrender was nowhere to be found. Even when no stray dogs roamed the streets, they had been eaten, and no large animals remained in the zoos, they had been slaughtered by government order in 1943, except for two elephants in Nagoya. Even then, the courage for a swift and unconditional surrender was nowhere to be found. In the infamous phrase, Hakko Ichiu, wartime Japan had proclaimed its sacred mission to unite the world under one imperial roof. Now Japanese with a roof over their heads were lucky. It was only at this late stage that the rivalries between Japan's service branches, the Army and the Navy, which had been the source of terrible strategic miscoordination and resource wastefulness, began to be overcome, but it was too late. Instead of defeat, military representatives in the High Councils talked of a decisive battle, or decisive battles, perhaps, nearer to Japan. As the fighting neared Japan, the military argued, problems of coordination and supply would be simpler, and then discipline and spirit would take such a toll on American lives that Japan would be in a better position to think about ending the war. Meanwhile, civilians began to drill with bamboo lances. But of course, the decisive battle had already happened. And in fact, it had already happened twice, once at Midway in 1942, and once at Leyte off the Philippines in October 1944. The Battle of Leyte Gulf was the largest naval battle in history, actually. It was a confrontation that involved 280 warships and about 200,000 sailors and airmen. And it also saw the first kamikaze attacks, so-called. It was, again, like Midway, a resounding Japanese defeat. In the words of one documentary, for Japan, Leyte Gulf was intended to be the decisive battle, which would halt the American advance across the Pacific. In reality, the Japanese Navy's last great gamble would lead to its complete destruction as a fighting force. In other words, it was indeed the decisive battle. Pearl Harbor had been intended to give Japan a free hand in the Pacific. Leyte Gulf, in fact, gave precisely that same free hand over to the Americans. The war was over, with the Navy and the merchant fleet decimated, the Philippines lost, and no hope of ever matching the extraordinary American industrial capacity, if nothing else. Then came Iwo Jima, a barren patch of volcanic rock in the Pacific that hosted about 50,000 casualties in February and March of 1945. Then in April came Okinawa, which resulted in a 250,000 casualties on the Japanese side alone. This was the same month that Italy surrendered. Germany followed on May 7th. Even now, with its allies gone and its empire in shabby tatters, Japan seemed frozen in inaction. Its cities in ruin, its population nearing malnutrition, its factories and shipyards without materials, and daily life disoriented in every possible respect. The arrogance of military spokesmen and the intrusive surveillance by police and bloc leaders began to be replaced by a state of shock and shared misery. Japan's military and civilian leadership failed to move, even in these conditions. Why? Well, it appears that there were at least two factors at work. First, as Andrew Gordon put it, the inner circle of senior statesmen around the throne feared the uncertainty of a peace that might bring down the imperial institution, more than the certainty of a war that would yield nothing but continued death and destruction. The Allied leadership had made it clear that only an unconditional surrender was acceptable. Roosevelt had first declared that no conditions should be attached to Japanese capitulation in 1943 at a meeting in Casablanca. Even those in the Japanese inner circles of power who advocated a peace settlement were unwilling to risk the imperial institution, so this was a non-starter. Second, the Japanese government was holding out hope that Russia, which was then publicly still neutral in the Pacific War and grievously wounded by the drawn-out savage war with Hitler's Reich, would intervene for Japan and help negotiate a surrender which guaranteed the maintenance of the Kokutai, in other words, the emperor system. Hirohito himself had informed his Supreme War Council that he desired peace, in other words, desired surrender, in June of 1945. But unbeknownst to the increasingly desperate Japanese, Stalin had actually already promised to enter the war against Japan in February at the Yalta Conference, in 2 or 3 months after Germany has surrendered and the war in Europe is terminated, in the wording of the protocol signed at Yalta. Despite Tokyo's offers of territorial concessions, Russia hemmed, hawed, and stalled, already planning to enter the war by around August 7th, 1945, a date that later would ring some bells because, well, yeah. In the meantime, Churchill and Stalin met with Truman, who had replaced Roosevelt, who had died in office. And this was not their first meeting, so they're meeting again. Chiang Kai-shek was also included by wire in this conference at Potsdam, Germany, where, on July 26, 1945, the Potsdam Declaration, which defined the terms of Japanese surrender, was signed. This confirmed the Allied commitment to an unconditional surrender by the Empire of Japan, and crushed the hopes for a negotiated peace. Incidentally, it also seems to have been the beginning of the post-war rift between the US and USSR. Stalin and Truman quickly developed a strong personal and political disliking for each other. In any case, with the Soviets scheduled to enter the war around August 7th, Truman authorized the use of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. On the morning of August 6, local time, an American B-29 Superfortress, dubbed the Enola Gay, after the pilot's mother, took off from Tinian, south of Saipan. It was accompanied by the observation plane Great Artiste and a plane tasked with photographing the bombing. This was later retroactively named Necessary Evil. The bomb, which was nicknamed Little Boy, delivered a roughly 16 kiloton destination, which destroyed about 70% of the city and killed almost 1 in 3 residents in the initial blast and firestorm. The Enola Gay's pilot was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. The same day, Truman issued a statement. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July 26 was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware. This is actually the warning which President Trump echoed when he promised North Korea that any future provocations would, quote, be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. For those who understood the quote's history and context, even if Trump didn't, it was chilling at best. On August 8th, Stalin did declare war on Japan, just in time to play second fiddle to the August 9th atomic bombing of Nagasaki, this time with a plutonium bomb called not Little Boy, but Fat Boy. Tokyo had tried to surrender by way of Moscow, only to be rebuffed with an additional declaration of war. In other words, they said, hey Stalin, could you help us surrender? And he said, sorry, no, I'm going to war with you instead. One U.S. diplomat later mused on this unprecedented irony, saying, it's doubtful whether ever before in history a government delivered a message indicating willingness to surrender and simultaneously was handed a declaration of war. So this is one reason that so much controversy has raged over Truman's decision. Without any obvious military necessity other than as an anti-Soviet deterrent, the annihilation of two additional Japanese cities came precisely on the deadline for Stalin's entry into the war on Japan. In other words, the story about preventing the loss of American lives in a prolonged, scorched-earth invasion of Japan is fairly hard for many people to accept. Marius Janssen hinted at the significance of Truman's decision when he argued that the atomic bombings transformed forever world strategic thinking and held up the picture of an Armageddon that has profound psychological consequences for people everywhere. The Japanese story, or stories, of a noble war to liberate Asia, followed by a noble surrender to save the world, ring equally untrue for many outside Japan. But inside Japan, they remain influential, if polarizing. On the one hand, the bombs did begin to authorize a much less domestically controversial narrative about Japan in the post-war. In other words, the idea of Japan as the victim both of irresponsible bad eggs in its own military high command and of the Americans and what Hirohito called their new and most cruel bomb. According to the historian James Orr, this victim consciousness, or hingaisha ishiki, quickly came to define Japan's representation, self-representation, and representation of itself to the world in the post-war years. And this peaked somewhere between 1955 and 1965, although it's never really gone away. As I mentioned in an earlier lecture, in the typical victim narrative, as Orr observed, transference of aggressive subjectivity usually involved placing the now innocent Japanese people on the high ground of victimhood. The role of victimizer was assigned to the military, to the militarist state, or to the vaguely defined entity called simply the system. Victim consciousness was important as Japan got back on its feet, as a result of the so-called special procurements by the U.S. Army for the Korean War. All told, between 1950 and 1953, $2.37 billion in special procurements for ammunition, trucks, uniforms, communications equipment, and other products from Japanese companies helped to reignite the economy. Prime Minister Yoshida, exhibiting the tact and delicacy that has typified the utterances of so many Japanese politicians, called the Korean War a godsend. And he wasn't alone. Toyota's CEO called special procurement orders the company's salvation. And the Bank of Japan's president made a timely reference to the divine wind, or kamikaze, which had saved Japan from Mongol invasions centuries earlier. In turn, the economic upturn of the special procurement boom from the Korean War helped to establish the system of conservative rule that continues more or less unmolested today in 2021, and which will be treated in future lectures. Conservative stability, though, was not the order of the day when Japan first surrendered. The first dozen years or so of the post-war period were actually quite messy and chaotic. The Allied occupation, which was de facto an American occupation, was driven by both the personal agenda of commanding officer General Douglas MacArthur and by a general statement of purpose from Washington, which defined the ultimate objectives of the USA vis-a-vis Japan as, quote, to ensure that Japan will not again become a menace to the United States or to the peace and security of the world, and two, to bring about the eventual establishment of a peaceful and responsible government which will respect the rights of other states and will support the objectives of the United States, as reflected in the ideals and principles of the Charter of the United Nations. The United States desires that this government should conform as closely as may be to principles of democratic self-government, but it is not the responsibility of the Allied powers to impose upon Japan any form of government not supported by the freely expressed will of the people. The occupation was a delicate balancing act. As Japan's oligarchs had done in the Meiji period, the new American oligarchs often had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake, though to be fair, the Genro did a better job of this balancing. The U.S., having stepped on the gas too hard in 1945, was actually forced into a whiplash reverse course in midstream, which may remind some of the conservative backlash of the 1880s that ended with the 1890 Constitution. In any case, the occupation was about structural reform, but also about winning hearts and minds. It was an audacious project described by one of its top officials as, quote, the greatest experiment in human relations in history. That official was Crawford Sams, who was an American doctor. Sams headed the Public Health and Welfare section of SCAP, the Supreme Command for the Allied Powers. Sams and his fellow occupiers had much to do, both in terms of practical measures to stabilize and rehabilitate Japan, and in terms of selling this agenda to the Japanese. Sams faced the particularly difficult problem of being the occupation's top health administrator at a time when, in the hiatus between the breakdown of Japanese rationing in 1944 and the beginning of organized, sustained Allied rationing in 1946, millions faced imminent starvation. MacArthur set up army kitchens and cabled Washington that he needed 3.5 million tons of food immediately. On the American side, nothing less than a complete and total revolution was in the works. For both the US and Japan, this was a year zero, and the analogy with Meiji was hardly lost on anyone. But the American occupiers were not pragmatic revolutionaries like the oligarchs, but idealist reformers. Their goal was to create a democratic and peace-loving Japan from the ashes of empire, avoiding the harsh retribution that had fueled German ressentiment and the rise of Hitler after World War II. Japan would be reborn as a capitalist democracy, molded in America's image. This goal reflected what is called democratic peace theory, the highly influential idea that democratic countries are less likely to go to war with each other. It is often conflated with capitalist peace theory, and to some extent, this was the case in post-war Japan, too. At the macro level, at least, this Herculean task had three major components. That was the three Ds: democratize, demilitarize, and deconcentrate. American General Douglas MacArthur, who I've already mentioned as the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, for SCAP, was the plenipotentiary dictator of occupied Japan. He was a terribly complex and difficult human being. His biographer called him American Caesar. He was a great, thundering paradox of a man, noble and ignoble, inspiring and outrageous, arrogant and shy, the best of men and the worst of men, the most protean, most ridiculous, and most sublime soldier who ever wore a uniform, again, in the words of his biographer. MacArthur also had a very clear vision of himself as Japan's savior, and despite having been humiliatingly defeated in the Philippines in the early stages of the Pacific War, he refused to exact vengeance. Instead, in his high-handed and self-righteous way, he wanted to be remembered to history as one whose sacred duty it became, once the guns were silenced, to carry to the land of our vanquished foe the solace and hope and faith of Christian morals. This was the fabled white man's burden in all its terrible, arrogant glory. But the dictatorial MacArthur, who radiated the self-assurance of the Crusader, was a good match for defeated Japan. He projected purpose and morality and dedication in the face of kyotatsu and self-flagellation and starvation. He was a magnet and an anchor in the hollowed-out center of beaten and beaten-down Japan. He was, if not the new emperor, at least the new shogun. MacArthur, as shogun, wielded a fabulous charisma that was a major factor in the success of American reformers in winning over the Japanese. As Marius Jansen put it, no one can deny that this was a fortunate match of man and task. Before plunging into the details of American post-war reforms and reconstruction, I should note that at all phases, the American occupation worked at least nominally through the Japanese government, which was never completely disbanded and purged. Sometimes SCAP pushed for a stronger vision of a proposed Japanese reform. Other times, Japanese politicians and bureaucrats pushed back against American proposals. Though the occupation is often thought of as a dictatorship, a period of authoritarian rule by fiat, carried out by the blue-eyed shogun, some also called him the nation's second emperor, and his subordinates, at this point you probably won't be surprised to hear that the reality was a bit more complex. In any case, as I said, the three major components of MacArthur's reform program were the three Ds: demilitarize, democratize, deconcentrate. As Andrew Gordon wrote, this three-pronged policy reflected a simple and very progressive, idealistic, even utopian belief that militarism stemmed from monopoly, tyranny, and poverty. MacArthur was eloquent on this point. The Japanese economic system, dominated by the zaibatsu, had permitted 10 family groups, comprising only 56 families, to control directly or indirectly every phase of slavery of the remainder of the Japanese people, permitted higher standards of life only through sufferance, and in a search for further plunder abroad, furnished the tools for the military to embark upon its ill-fated venture into world conquest. Crushing the zaibatsu, purging the militarists, and providing a decent standard of living to the mass of Japanese impoverished by those evil rulers would put the Japanese nation on a path to recovery. The United States seems to have forgotten how successful these efforts were, not to mention that, for better and worse, this was the shape and substance of MacArthur's solace and hope and faith of Christian morals, as implemented in an absolutely unprecedented project of social, political, and economic reform. Demilitarization began basically immediately. The special higher police, the Thought Police, were disbanded in October. By the end of November, the Army and Navy were also dissolved. So, by the end of 1945, you had gotten rid of the Thought Police and the Army and Navy. Actual demobilization, which is, I guess, another of the possible Ds, is a more challenging task because you have 3.7 million soldiers and actually also 3.2 million civilians stationed or living overseas at the time of surrender. So you have to sort of find a place for them. Excepting about 400,000 or so who remained as prisoners in the Soviet Union, nearly 7 million Japanese were repatriated, in the parlance of the day, by the end of 1948. Many civilians, of course, were actually patriated because they had been born and raised in Japan's colonies and had never been to Japan before. And many, both soldiers and civilians, were unwelcome at home, both because they represented the shame of defeat in a now meaningless and devastating war, and because, as noted, there wasn't any food or shelter to spare, even before these millions of excess military men and also civilians descended upon the broken home islands. In the days of shortage and a breakdown of public services, demobilized men could expect little from their fellow citizens and nothing from their government, which was forbidden to pay pensions. Demilitarization was a priority not solely because the Allies desired present and future peace and wanted to hamstring any future Japanese military resurgence, but also because the military, independent of a civilian control and legally responsible only to the emperor himself, had been able to act with impunity and dictate policy. Just to be sure, though, the powerful home ministry was also torn down. An often forgotten but equally important problem was the flip side of repatriation. In other words, the question of what to do with the now suddenly foreign again Koreans, Taiwanese, and others stranded in Japan. The case of Koreans in particular is illustrative. Because Koreans had been mobilized for war along with other Japanese subjects after 1937, and many men had been forced to labor in factories or on the fronts, many women made into de facto or actual sex slaves. In 1939, in the interest of promoting greater unity under Japanese rule, colonial authorities pressured Koreans to adopt Japanese names. About 80% or so complied. But when the war ended, Korea ceased to be a Japanese possession, and the estimated 2 million or so ethnic Koreans in Japan ceased to be Japanese subjects. Ethnic Koreans were now foreigners resident in Japan, and their official redefinition as Zaimichi, or Japanese residents, reflected the expectation that these temporary residents would someday leave. And someday soon, it apparently was hoped, because Zainichi Koreans were stripped of their voting rights by the end of that year and made lawful aliens under the Alien Registration Act of 1947. So they had gone from essentially second-class citizens in Japanese Empire to non-citizen, essentially almost stateless people, and they actually become stateless over time. In 1950, the new nationality law allowed only Zainichi children with Japanese fathers to keep their Japanese citizenship. Koreans were not the only non-Japanese affected by the implementation of patrilineal jus sanguinis. As of 1952, former colonial subjects whose homeland was not recognized by Japan as a legitimate nation-state, including Korea, were rendered stateless. In 1955, a law required that all registered foreigners be fingerprinted. Ethnic Koreans were even excluded from the rights granted to non-nationals in Japan's constitution. Employment policies excluded Koreans from all Japanese jobs after 1945. Barred from all public and private sector employment, Koreans pursued jobs in the informal sector and engaged in illegal or marginal economic activities, such as illegal alcohol production, scrap recycling, and racketeering. And in fact, one of my bosses in Japan was one of these people. The ironies and inconsistencies of Japan's treatment of its former imperial subjects is well summarized by John Lai. I think you'll also hear his name pronounced John Lee. I'm not sure which he prefers, but in any case, he wrote, quite frequently, the Japanese authorities had it both ways. Ethnic Koreans were stripped of their suffrage, in 1945, presumably because they were not Japanese. But their effort to create ethnic schools was denied in 1948 because they were Japanese nationals. Although some Koreans were arrested as Japanese war criminals, other Koreans were fired from government jobs because they were no longer Japanese nationals. By the early 1960s, almost 90,000 of these resident Koreans had chosen life in North Korea over life in Japan, though the realities of life in the DPRK discouraged immigrants after the first few years. Returning to the occupation, though, in addition to demilitarization, The GHQ, the General Headquarters, which was headed by MacArthur, was intent on deconcentrating the business sector in Japan by breaking up the zaibatsu and democratizing the public sphere with a new, truly representative government and progressive democratic social institutions. The zaibatsu were one of the major targets of the occupation's deconcentration of wealth and industrial power. The effort to tear these monopolies apart had been it had both specific and general roots. On the one hand, it was the result of specific American beliefs that the zaibatsu had been among the chief and most effective supporters of the 1930s aggression by Japan. There was also the more general American pro-free trade, antitrust, anti-monopoly sort of ideological stance. The zaibatsu were dissolved, their holding companies were outlawed, their family stocks were confiscated and sold to the public. Zaibatsu families also were banned from their own companies. These companies, bound together in a complex sort of affiliate system of networks, were split apart, and antitrust legislation and a fair trade commission was put in place. This was an attack on economic inequality, which MacArthur and his reformers saw as a primary goal of, a primary cause of Japanese support for militarists. Perhaps surprisingly, given generally strong American anti-communist, anti-socialist leanings, the occupiers released communist and socialist wartime thought criminals in October 1945 and confiscated the land in the hands of big landlords, giving it away to their tenants. In its final form, land reform carried out on the occupation's watch forced landlords to sell off all but a small family-sized plot of farmland to tenants at 1945 prices. These prices had actually been fixed in 1939. So by the time this policy was implemented in October of 1946, post-war hyperinflation had devalued the real cost of a tenant's field so far that this was essentially a Robin Hood-style giveaway, taking from the rich, even if they weren't so rich, and giving to the poor. And yet, in its results, this in no way ran counter to the American veneration of private property and the free market. Instead, land reform was a necessary evil that created a nation of small family farms. In other words, a conservative culture of ownership, which was born from a radically progressive land grab, because instead of making that land public and communal, which would have been the case under communism, it was returned to private hands, albeit different private hands. Production methods didn't really change, but the class structure of rural Japan was radically altered. In fact, as I've just suggested, landlords were not in a particularly strong position by the end of the war. While they had been ascendant in the first several decades of the 20th century, even in the face of tenant protests demanding rent reduction and other concessions, the wartime regime had probably unintentionally weakened the economic position of landlords when it subsidized purchases of tenant rice in order to promote increased food production. But in fact, agriculture ministry bureaucrats had been pushing for reforms since the 1930s. In any case, land reform was much more enduring and impactful in many ways than zaibatsu busting, in very large part because of the so-called reverse course, which came midway through the occupation and which we'll discuss in the future. The GHQ did not just weaken or execute the upper echelons of Japanese society. The Americans also worked to strengthen labor through reforms. SCAP considered strong unions essential to the creation of anti-militarist, progressive, and democratic public attitudes. In 1946, the Japanese Diet was prompted to pass a number of laws which legalized unions, strikes, and collective bargaining, and set working standards. By the end of the year, with these legal measures in place and a great deal of pound-the-pavement proselytizing by the occupation, there were 4.8 million unionized laborers in Japan, which were broken down into 17,000 or so unions. The Labor Ministry, founded in 1947, pushed for unions and for collective bargaining because the ministry believed that this would produce the most stable and productive economy. Unions had existed prior to the 15-year war, but membership peaked around 420,000 or so, a small fraction of all workers, in 1936. As Japan mobilized for war after that, labor unions were abolished completely in 1940. This was intended to prevent labor disruptions and to quell political discourse. Occupation-era labor laws reversed this trend. Union membership swelled to a high of around 6.5 million, about half of all Japanese employees in 1948-49, before dropping off again to about one-third, where it remained stable for the next two decades or so. Unions would also be very important to the reverse course, so we're going to keep them in mind as we move forward. Democratization was a longer game than either demilitarization or decentralization. Certainly, labor reform was part of this effort to democratize. So was educational reform. In addition to replacing the multiple-track wartime school system with a more egalitarian one that was also compulsory up to ninth grade, the content of education was completely overhauled. If this brings to mind the reforms of the Meiji period, when universal conscription and compulsory public education were part of the long-term plan of forming a new nation, well, congratulations, you've been paying attention. The occupiers placed militarist nationalism and an emperor-centered morality, which was heavy on obedience and light on creativity, they replaced this with a curriculum that emphasized personal rights, self-government, and other virtues needed for the creation of autonomous, responsible, engaged citizens. Women were allowed to attend university beginning in 1947. Like many other reforms, this radical about-face resulted in relatively little resistance because the old value system had been so thoroughly and irrefutably defeated and therefore discredited in the eyes of the majority of Japanese. Now, it took some time for the new values of American-style democracy to catch on. For a while, the ideological lexicon of the Americans was an impenetrable mass of half-understood syllables, but many Japanese were happy to give up whatever it was that had brought down the unprecedented destruction and humiliation and hardship upon them. This is not to say that educational reform, or really any other reform, was universally welcomed. After all, as Andrew Gordon remarked, these ideas of reform implied to many, and this was both promise and threat, a remaking of the human soul. Labor and education reforms were important long-term investments in the creation of a democratic society, but so too were legal reforms. In this sense, the American project to democratize Japan was both practically and symbolically encapsulated in the Emperor's Declaration of His Own Humanity on January 1, 1946, and the new post-war constitution ratified in November of that year and implemented on May 3, 1947. The story and content of the Constitution is quite extraordinary, and it deserves detailed attention. It also helps to set up the next topic for the immediate Reconstruction, which was the question of war responsibility. Japan surrendered, as we know, in September of 1945. By October, SCAP was already ordering not only the educational, economic, and labor reforms which I've just discussed, but also ordering that women should be granted the right to vote. Much of this was made permanent and fundamental to the post-war Japanese state in the 1947 Constitution. And the illustration here is actually from a government publication, a publication of the Ministry of Education. You can see the Constitution rising like the sun in the distance, and the joyous people who are enjoying the three pillars of post-war the post-war system. One is the principle of the right of the peoples, essentially, to self-determination. The other two are democracy and international peace. The Japanese committee established in October 45 to consider constitutional revision produced a conservative proposal. So this entirely failed to live up to American expectations, especially in terms of the role and authority of the emperor. In other words, the occupation did give Japan a chance to write its own constitution. What came out was unacceptable. So MacArthur rejected it and ordered SCAP's government section to draft a new constitution instead. The committee of 16 officers and four civilians who were assigned to this monumental task was given 1 week to fulfill it. Now, only four of these those who were charged with this duty were actually lawyers. Only one had intimate knowledge of Japan and its people and language. That individual is pictured here. This is Beata Sirota, who later married and became Beata Sirota Gordon. She was, at the time, a 22-year-old Viennese-born American-educated woman who had spent 10 years in Japan as a girl when her father, who was a celebrated Jewish pianist, had fled Europe because of the Nazis. The Committee of 24 worked feverishly and in secret around the clock to produce a constitutional draft, driving around burned-out Tokyo to collect and read every example of a constitution which they could get their hands on. The result is a gloriously progressive document, and Beata Sirota left her imprint as firmly as any member of the group, because she was, as the title of her memoir modestly put it, the only woman in the room. She was the only woman in the room when General Courtney Whitney doled out assignments. She was the youngest as well. She was given the unique opportunity and burden to write the section on women's rights, for example. Essentially, Whitney said, well, you're a woman, so, you know, do the woman's stuff. She did, and she did it with extraordinary courage and aplomb. In fact, the whole Constitution is really a marvel in many ways, not least of which is its longevity. Over 70 years on, the 1947 Constitution has yet to be revised. The fundamental law of Japan has survived unamended because it is a soaring declaration of goals and objectives. It's a blueprint for the national legal, social, and economic systems. It's free from specifics in most areas, meaning that revisions can be made either by changing individual laws or tweaking the interpretation of the Constitution without actually altering the document itself. The preamble of the Constitution opens with a riff on the American Constitution's famous opening, "We the People." "We the Japanese people," begins the 1947 Constitution of Japan. And this in and of itself was already a radical transformation. The Meiji Constitution of 1890 was written with an entirely different "we" as its protagonist. It began, "Having by virtue of the glories of our ancestors ascended the throne of a lineal succession unbroken for ages eternal, blah blah blah," the emperor using the royal "we." More than that, the emperor's oath upon the promulgation of the Constitution began, "We, the successor to the prosperous throne of our predecessors, blah blah blah." So the subject of the Constitution is a very different "we." All eight articles of the Constitution's first chapter, however, deal with the emperor. The most important is Article 1, which includes this piece. "The emperor shall be the symbol of the state and of the unity of the people, deriving his position from the will of the people, within whom resides sovereign power." Chapter 2 is comprised of a single article, the famous Article 9. "Aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation, and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. In order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized." Articles 10 to 40, in other words, Chapter 3, establish the rights and duties of Japanese nationals. Included are fundamental human rights, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and a bevy of civil rights, including the rights to work, equal education, fair treatment under the law, and also minimum standards of wholesome and cultured living, quote unquote. Beata Sirota, at the time, wrote Article 24, and also part of Article 14. That part of Article 14 reads, "All of the people are equal under the law, and there shall be no discrimination in political, economic, or social relations because of race, creed, sex, social status, or family origin." Article 24, which is longer, it says, "Marriage shall be based only on the mutual consent of both sexes, and it shall be maintained through mutual cooperation, with the equal rights of husband and wife as a basis. With regard to choice of spouse, property rights, inheritance, choice of domicile, divorce, and other matters pertaining to marriage and the family, laws shall be enacted from the standpoint of individual dignity and the essential equality of the sexes." Given that the previously active Meiji Civil Code had defined women as quasi-incapacitated, in other words, semi-competent, this was a major step forward in law, if not immediately in practice. Chapter 4 deals with the Diet, the Japanese Parliament. Then you have Chapter 5 about the Cabinet, 6 about the Judiciary, etc., etc. And the final chapters are, for our purposes, essentially miscellanea. In other words, it's really Chapters 1 through 3 that are the most important. Constitutional reform was central to the rebuilding of Japan. After all, a constitution is a roadmap for the nation. The prominent place of the emperor in Chapter 1 is an admission of the importance of Hirohito and the imperial institution to the project of getting Japan not back on its feet so much as getting it new shoes. But the carefully neutered symbolic function of the emperor did not really square with a realistic assessment of war responsibility, let alone the desire for vengeance in Asia, in the United States, and to a lesser extent in Japan, against the man for whom Japan had gone to war. At the outset, the GHQ, the General Headquarters, which is functionally the same as SCAP, the Supreme Command for the Allied Powers, intended to remove all supporters of the military state. Now, needless to say, this was an enormous task, since in one way or another, and whether willingly or not, just about everyone had actually been a supporter of the state and its colonial and military misdeeds. Blunt instruments and blanket categories ruled the day. By 1948, more than 200,000 bureaucrats and business leaders were purged because they were judged responsible for leading the war effort. An additional 6,000 military men were tried for war crimes, including the abuse of Allied POWs. Over 900 of these were executed. Reparations were also paid out to Japan's Asian wartime victims. On the other, the emperor was merely demoted to symbol. War crimes trials were carried out, and some men were executed, others were imprisoned. Tojo Hideki, pictured here on the right, was hung. Abe Shinzo's grandfather was held for more than 3 years as a suspected war criminal, before being released, and eventually becoming prime minister twice. Hirohito was never held or accused, even once. He did, as I've said, renounce his divinity on New Year's Day 1946, but he was never made to admit anything more than a sense of regret. This was a pragmatic decision, whether we like it or not, which was made essentially in the name of keeping Japan manageable in the short run and redeemable in the long run. It reflected the best understanding of the supreme command of SCAP, namely that Emperor Hirohito had presided over Japan's descent into aggressive war. His presence had legitimated council decisions of the greatest import. Service chiefs reported directly to him, and minutes of meetings found him occasionally questioning policy or procedure. In other words, he was responsible. On the other hand, he had also been instrumental in bringing about the surrender, and his cooperation was important in securing that of his people, and certainly of the military. More to the point, a study conducted by MacArthur's advisors concluded that, quote, to dethrone or hang the emperor would cause a tremendous and violent reaction from all Japanese. Hanging of the emperor would, to them, would be comparable to the crucifixion of Christ to us. All would fight to die like ants. In other words, the long-term repercussions of deicide would be unacceptable, the casualties too high. This is obviously a controversial, complex topic, and it's not one we have enough time to deal with here. But the decision to allow Hirohito to live on untouched as the symbol of the state and of the unity of the people was tremendously unpopular, especially in the Asian nations which had suffered under Japanese colonial and military rule. So, seen in the most positive light possible, it could, however, be argued that avoiding the question of guilt for one man, Hirohito, was a pragmatic choice to avoid endless counterinsurgency and terrorism, and instead to set Japan as a whole on the track to recovery, as soon and as efficiently as possible. In a sense, the occupation treated Hirohito as a cooperating witnesses, in other words, sort of state's evidence in the trial of Japan. And then he served the recovery effort much better in his capacity as the civilian symbolic emperor than he would have as executed war criminal and therefore martyr. While Japan has now spent decades as one of the world's leading proponents of peace and democracy around the world, both the government and people of Japan have often been accused of failing to adequately address, accept, and make amends for Japan's colonial and wartime misdeeds. Undoubtedly, a good portion of the blame here goes to the U.S. occupation, in addition to the blame that goes to the Japanese themselves. As John Dower put it, the occupation came close to turning the entire issue of war responsibility into a joke. If the man in whose name Imperial Japan had conducted foreign and military policy for 20 years was not held accountable for the initiation or conduct of the war, why should anyone expect ordinary people to dwell on such matters, or to think seriously about their own personal responsibility? And as you might expect, Japanese government and elites were no help. Prince Higashikuni Naruhiko, the prime minister of the surrender cabinet, who was also uncle to Hirohito, explained to journalists that Japan's defeat had myriad intertwined causes, from military errors to declining public morality. He then spread the blame as thinly as possible, diffusing it over the entire nation when he declared, quote, "I believe that the collective repentance of the 100 million, this famous phrase, Ichiyok Souzange, is the first step in the resurrection of our country, the first step in bringing unity to our country." Many were stunned, if not outraged, as Francisca Serafim noted, when Higashikuni in effect declared the people responsible for military defeat, exempting no one but the emperor. Attempts like this by those in the innermost circles of power to pass the buck only served to confirm the suspicion of many Japanese that they were, above all, victims of their own government and its irresponsible militarist wingnuts. In any case, giving Hirohito a pass on war crimes was not the only failing, irony, or contradiction of Japan's defeat, surrender, and occupation. The one condition which the Japanese leadership had placed on surrender for in the months before Hiroshima and Nagasaki was that they would get to retain the emperor. Despite eventually being forced by the atomic bombings and Soviet intervention to give up on that condition, it was actually fulfilled, at least partially, as a result of the exigencies of Reconstruction. It's possible to see a great deal of irony in this, and I certainly do, but it was hardly the only irony of the occupation. Incidentally, on the same day that it carried the full text of Hirohito's renunciation of his own divinity in January 1946, the New York Times sensationally reported that, quote, "history teaching is banned in Japan." While on the one hand this was part of SCAP's education reform package, it's also an example of censorship. Perhaps nothing is more indicative of the towering contradictions of the American occupation than the conflict between the U.S.-authored Constitution's Article 21 and the draconian censorship regime immediately imposed upon defeated Japan and maintained until sovereignty was returned to Japan in 1952. I should say it was a little bit less strict after 1949. But in any case, Article 21 reads in full, quote, "Freedom of assembly and association, as well as speech, press, and all other forms of expression are guaranteed. No censorship shall be maintained, nor shall the secrecy of any means of communication be violated." Let's let this sink in for a minute. The Constitution guarantees freedom of speech, expression, assembly, association, press. It forbids censorship. And yet, starting in September 1945, the same month that it began issuing preliminary directives about press freedom, SCAP went ahead without any apparent sense of the stunning contradictions to monitor and or censor anything and everything. Books and textbooks, newspapers and magazines, public performances, mail, phone calls, etc. The list of censored topics is extensive. In June 1946, for example, it included criticism of SCAP, the U.S., Great Britain, China, the Allied Russia, Korea, and the war crimes trials, propaganda, promoting nationalism, militarism, feudalism, and the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. There is even a blanket category for general propaganda. It also included incitements to violence, and amazingly, both a ban on untrue statements and on references to censorship. So, talking about censorship was censored. Even though it's generally acknowledged to have been less extensive and less oppressive than wartime censorship by Japan itself, SCAP's censorship apparatus employed over 6,000 people at its peak, and during the 4 years it was in operation, spot-checked an astonishing 330 million pieces of mail, monitored some 800,000 private phone conversations, etc. Press censors reviewed a monthly average of 26,000 issues of newspapers, 3,800 news agency publications, 23,000 radio scripts, 5,700 printed bulletins, 4,000 magazine issues, 1,800 books and pamphlets. And as John Dower pointed out, because the existence of censorship was never publicly acknowledged, In the best Orwellian manner, these taboos included any public acknowledgement of the existence of censorship. Scaff's censorship in the name of free speech may have been schizophrenic, but, like so many of the Americans' measures, it had much the desired effect. So, this has been a little bit of a long lecture, and one of the reasons for this is quite simple. As Dauer observed in his canonical history of the occupation years and their aftermath, quote, "The years of war, defeat, and occupation left an indelible mark on those who lived through them. No matter how affluent the country later became, these remained the touchstone years for thinking about national identity and personal values. The passage of 7 decades has made this less true than it once was, but nevertheless, the years of the war and occupation are absolutely critical to understanding the shape of post-war Japan, right up to the present." In our next lecture, we're going to look at the reverse course, which accompanied the onset of the Cold War, and we'll also look at the beginnings of the so-called economic miracle, which kicked off after the end of the occupation. Before doing so, two things. So one is, of course, a summary of this lecture. We began by looking at the road to surrender, and we looked at a little bit at the road to reform and recovery, focusing really on the occupation. To get there, we talked about the atomic bombings and their sort of political implications, as well as their military implications, which are more obvious. And we talked about the radical reconstruction of Japan's legal, political, economic, social structures, etc., during the first years under the auspices of the U.S. occupation. In particular, I emphasized the 3 Ds, democratize, demilitarize, deconcentrate. And finally, we touched on the issue of war responsibility, particularly that of the emperor. Before I sign off here, though, for today, I want to add a few open-ended observations about defeat, surrender, and the occupation. So first, the January 1st, 1946 New York Times article, which reported the ban on history education, which I mentioned before, specified that plans were already in the works to build the new out of the old. Quote, "Textbooks and teachers' manuals must be collected and destroyed, and the pulp used to make new books from which militaristic ideas are eliminated. The pulping and recycling of the old Japan isn't quite the right metaphor for the occupation's national renewal project, but it is suggestive of both the importance of history education to national identity and also the way that the old and new were connected in post-war Japan." General MacArthur's response to the Emperor's Declaration of Humanity on that same New Year's Day, 1946, encapsulates much of the same condescension and arrogance and optimism and idealism of the occupation. MacArthur wrote, "The Emperor's New Year's statement pleases me very much. By it, he undertakes a leading part in the democracy of his people, democratization of his people. He squarely takes his stand for the future along liberal lines. His action reflects the irresistible influence of a sound idea. A sound idea cannot be stopped. For all its superciliousness and its massive conceit, for all its stink of Orientalism and racism," you should know that MacArthur once remarked that average Japanese would be pliable because they had the intelligence and maturity of 12-year-olds. "For all these failings, MacArthur's American idea for a resurrected and reconstructed Japan was fundamentally sound and fundamentally laudable." In 1945, already on August 30th, when he was still on board his plane on the way to Japan to take over as the sort of new shogun, if you will, he left the following concise mission statement, one of the most ambitious political manifestos ever written. "First, destroy the military power. Punish war criminals. Build the structure of representative government. Modernize the Constitution. Hold free elections. Enfranchise the women. Release the political prisoners. Liberate the farmers. Establish a free labor movement. Encourage a free economy. Abolish police oppression. Develop a free and responsible press. Liberalize education. Decentralized political power. Separate the church and state."